Hello and welcome to another edition of Inside Network Marketing. This is your host, Len Clements. This is June 6, 2012. I believe this is show number 18, and it has been 6 days short of a year since the last time that I actually did one of these podcasts. And that has been primarily because being an MLM watchdog advocate, guru, reporter, whatever you want to call what I do, it doesn't pay very well. In fact, it pays not at all. So I'd be out there making a living, and that includes at this point doing a lot of consulting, expert witness testimony, things like that. And that's kind of defeats the whole purpose of getting involved in network marketing, actually, because it's, you know, if I stop doing that, I stop getting paid. So eventually I'm going to get back in the trenches in here and start building a downline again. But right now, when someone says, here's $9,000 design a comp plan or a $5,000 retainer to do an expert witness job or something, that's really good now money, and I got to take it. And then when I get those kind of jobs, I got to focus on them. But at this point, I'm just going to find some time to start doing these podcasts again, because there's a lot of people that I want to interview with a lot of tough questions I want to ask them. And there's just a lot of stuff that I got to get off my chest. And it's just backing up too much, and it's just causing a lot of like stress and tension for me, because I just can't express some of these concerns. And you know, this is an industry that I keep hearing all of these MLM pundits and prognosticators and commenters out there talking about how we're a business that's finally getting mainstream, that there's you know, we're finally getting this recognition and this credibility and this acceptance in the marketplace, you know, that we've been trying to get for so long. I don't know what network marketing industry they're looking at, but it's sure not the one that I see. I see an industry full of immense potential to achieve that someday, but I just don't see it happening right now, and a lot of it is self-inflicted. There's a lot of criticism on this industry that's completely undeserved. In fact, most of the anti-MLM critics out there, you know, their arguments against us can be completely debunked in a very historical, mathematical, logical, legal way. But a lot of their criticisms are deserved. I mean, we're just asking for it, especially when it comes to the nature of our products. But that'll be, you know, that's a rant for the future. The main things I want to talk about on this particular show, which is I really still want to commit to keeping under an hour. I failed miserably the last time I did this, but I'm going to try to stick to that, is just a couple of issues that are fairly timely. One is this issue of short-selling publicly traded MLM companies, which is still kind of a hot topic again. And I got to talk about what I would just call fake MLM gurus. There's just a lot of people out there that are not just padding their resume. They're basically just making crap up about who they are and their success and things like that. So I'm going to get to that in a minute as well, too, because there's some things that have happened recently that just really gotten me kind of in a rage about that. And then I'll do more of these calls, hopefully, on at least a weekly basis to get a lot of other issues out there that I think really need to be exposed. And unfortunately, yeah, I'm probably going to focus on the negative, because, you know, we're an industry where if we don't recognize it's broke, who's going to fix it? And right now, it just seems like everybody wants to just talk about the positive side and build up the industry credibility and things like that. And that's great. There's absolutely a place for that. But the companies themselves and the distributors themselves do a great job of edifying their own companies in the industry. Somewhere, someone's got to say, yeah, but here are the bad guys. Here are the bad companies. Here's what's going wrong. And here are some possible solutions. I intend to do that as well. I mean, offer some alternatives and some ways to fix these problems. And, you know, it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. And unfortunately, I'm going to probably piss off a lot of people and a lot of companies. Back when I used to do this in an old newsletter form back in the 90s, where I would expose companies and things like that, I've had 7 death threats. And 2 of them, I believe, were actually serious. So it's so those will probably start up again now, too. But anyway, let's get into this. There was a situation actually a couple of weeks ago where a short seller, a very, very well-known, very well-respected, actually, short seller in the business, David Einhorn, got on a investor call for Herbalife, and he asked a couple of pretty basic, what should have been innocuous questions, but that kind of touched off this sort of firestorm, like, you know, oh, he's going to come in and he's just going to bash Herbalife because he's probably short their stock, and when he makes their stock go down, he's going to make money, kind of like what Barry Minkow did, you know, back in 07 and 08. And by the way, short selling means you invest in such a way where you actually make money if the company's stock goes down instead of making money by it going up. I want to explain the mechanisms of it. That's just basically how it works. So these are people like Barry Minkow I mentioned. I won't get into his whole story again, but if you go to minkowbelowtheiceberg.com, you will get the whole Barry Minkow story. Short version is, this was a guy back in 07, was paid several hundred thousand dollars, actually, I think a total of about $300,000 from various different other short sellers. In fact, I think about a couple hundred thousand of it came from a guy by the name of Sam Antar, who actually was prosecuted and found guilty of stock fraud in an old company called Crazy Eddie. And Barry Minkow at one time ran Z-Best Carpet Cleaning back in the 80s and was busted for stock fraud and went to prison for it. So both of these guys are now back and they're claiming they're going to be fraud busters. You know, they're going to expose all these scams. And actually, Barry did a really good job of that in the beginning. He had several legitimate Ponzi schemes that he exposed. But then Sam paid him a couple hundred thousand, a couple of the short sellers threw in some money and said, you know what, write up a really negative report, Barry, about USANA. And we'll all invest in it. And as soon as you make their stock price go down, well, you know, because we're shorting their stock, we're all going to make all this money. And Barry had a lot of credibility at the time. He was getting interviewed on CNBC and all these kind of, you know, television shows. So he said, great, let's do that. So he wrote this big, long 86-page report that was just garbage, essentially, in the arguments that it made against USANA. But he did get their stock price to drop 15% the very first day it was published. And it continued to drop, I think, another 40%, because he kept producing these very well-produced, very well-funded, very professional-looking YouTube videos, and he developed all these websites and stuff. Because, of course, once that worked against USANA, he did the same thing against Herbalife. He hit Nu Skin, he hit Medifast, he hit Prepay Legal. Because he found, you know, if I say negative things and make up garbage about these publicly traded MLM companies, I can make their stock go down really easy. So we're all short it, we'll make all this money. And he had all these enablers out there, like, you know, Tracy Conan and various other people that just sort of embraced everything that he did. Tracy Conan, by the way, is a certified fraud examiner and forensic accountant. And she was actually working with Barry in what was essentially extortion plots, and yet somehow was oblivious to the fact that's what he was doing. Now, we know that he was doing that now because ultimately he settled with USANA when they sued him, and he took all their stuff down, but he got paid to take it all down. Same with Herbalife. Herbalife didn't actually sue him, but they paid him off, I think $200,000 or $300,000 or something like that. And then he actually not only took everything down, but actually turned around and said Herbalife was a great company. With legitimate products and stuff. At one point, Barry was even saying that their products and some Nu Skin and USANA products had deadly levels of lead in them. But then all of a sudden, I guess the lead just went away as soon as he got paid off by these companies. Well, then he went after a non-MLM company called Lennar, second largest home builder in the country, and tried the same deal with them, like pay me and I'll make all this stuff go away. Well, they decided they were going to fight back, took him to court. Bottom line is he's back in prison again now for stock fraud, because he basically ran an extortion plot on them and tried to manipulate their stock by making up a lot of negative information about them. So that was essentially, at least in my opinion, based on how it appeared, the exact same things he was doing with these MLM companies. And we know that he didn't have a legitimate case against them because his actions did initiate an SEC investigation against USANA and Herbalife, and those investigations ended with nothing happening. They found nothing. And four different class action lawsuits were filed against USANA as a result of this. Three of them were dismissed because the plaintiff dropped a case. One of them was dismissed on summary, which means the judge looked at it and said, there is so little evidence against USANA in this case, you have so little chance of prevailing in this case, we're not even going to waste the court's time. No, you can't even sue them. Just go away. So that's what it means when you get a case dismissed on summary. So again, there was nothing there, but it still worked. Got their stock price to go down, and made, at one point, I think Barry said in a deposition, he made over $1 million by doing this. So David Einhorn. So David Einhorn comes on Herbalife's investor call, and he asks this question. The main question was, what happens to the product after your distributors buy it? How much of it is actually retailed to non-distributors? And he also asked some questions about how they account for their different ranks and their plans and things like that. But that was the big one right there. How do you track the retailed product? Now, when this call was over, everyone thought, well, you know what? David Einhorn must be working on a short case against Herbalife. And we've got this thing called the Iris Own Conference coming up that he's going to speak at. I bet you he's going to present his short case against USANA. And as soon as he does that, the stock price is going to plummet because he's done that with other companies in the past. And he's, you know, when he makes a short case against them, their stock price just plummets. So that's what he's going to do with Herbalife. Well, I pretty much had an idea that's not what he was going to do because, well, for one thing, unlike a lot of other people in this business that were commenting on this, I actually investigated it and learned about David Einhorn and his practices and who he was. And actually, I read some articles about him and some commentary. I actually spoke to two different other hedge funds that know him personally that gave me their opinions of him and so forth. And what I discovered was is that David is not Barry Minkow. David Einhorn is a guy who doesn't make a short case against a company unless he actually believes its stock is overvalued. He doesn't just short them gratuitously because somebody paid him to or whatever, and he just makes money because his reputation causes stocks to go down if he says bad things about them. That's not David Einhorn. So being the type of guy who really would do a due diligence and investigate these companies that he's making short cases against means, unlike Barry Minkow, he wouldn't just go to the anti-MLM people. Barry needed to make a short case against USANA, so he went to people like Tracy Conan and John Taylor and Robert Fitzpatrick, these anti-MLM critics out there, because he needed ammunition to make a negative case. That was his sole purpose. David Einhorn wants to know the truth. Is this stock overvalued or is it not? Which means he would have talked to both sides. Well, I sent out messages to what I felt were the top 15 people in this business that people would actually call if you wanted to find out both sides of the story, the top sort of authorities or experts in the business. 14 of them very quickly responded back. One, of which I won't name, didn't, but I didn't expect him to. But anyway, the other 14 did, and every one of them said, David Einhorn or Greenlight Capital, you know, his hedge fund firm, they've never contacted us or asked us anything. Well, that was a pretty big sign that he really wasn't doing anything with Herbalife. And his questions, as in Herbalife's press release after this said, because by the way, when he just asked the question on this call, their stock dropped 22% that same day. Everybody said, oh, he must be working on a short case against USANA, so let's get out now before the stock goes down, and that caused the stock to drop way down. You know, before he even said a short case. So Herbalife's press release in response to this was, look, these are pretty basic questions, kind of like questions someone would ask that's kind of new to the space, pretty fundamental, and they're right, it was. First of all, anyone who knows this business at all would know there is no answer to the question how much your product is retailed to non-distributors. There is no reliable way to ever produce that type of data. I mean, think about it. I mean, the vast majority of people in this business are not professional business people. They don't have accountants or anything like that. Sure, I guess they can do retail receipts, but can you imagine all of these non-business people, most of which are in the business for a few weeks and leave as soon as they get a couple of no's? I mean, that's the majority of people out there in this business. They're going to keep reliable sales receipts, and they're going to have to submit them somehow to the company. And of course, if they required that, people would just probably fake retail receipts. What about products that's sold on, you know, eBay or Craigslist? Most companies forbid that, but some of them do. I mean, do you count that as a sale? What about yard sales or flea markets? I mean, if you sell your product there, which is not a very good way to do it, but some people do it, I mean, is that a retail sale? I mean, what if they charge less than wholesale for the product? They charge under wholesale for the product to a retail customer. Does that still count as a retail sale? And what if they sell to another distributor, but it's out of their own inventory? Would that count? Now, sure, a lot of companies have online ordering and they drop ship, and a lot of party plan companies do that. But that might be less than half the volume of some of those party plan type companies, because a lot of that's sold right there at the home party. There's certainly, you can track some of it because a lot of it's ordered online. But, you know, what about retail customers who say, I really love these products, I'm buying it regularly anyway, I want to get it a little cheaper, I'm already recommending it to some of my friends, so I'm going to sign up as a distributor. Should they not count as a retail customer anymore? Now, so again, companies come up with ballpark estimates. They can do that, but I don't think Wall Street, or surely the SEC, are looking for ballpark estimates. You know, that's not going to work there. I'm sure that wouldn't probably satisfy people like David Einhorn. There's simply no reliable way to actually track what happens to product once it gets into the hands of the distributor? Where does it go after that? There is no answer to that question. Anybody who knows the business would know there's really no reliable answer to that question. So he was just kind of poking around and sort of learning a little bit about the business. And bottom line, the Irisone conference came and went, and David Einhorn didn't say one word about Herbalife. And of course, the stock went way back up. In fact, I actually watched it live, and I saw the stock go up, like right when he was done speaking. You know, it's like, oh, he didn't say anything, everybody's going to buy the stock back again. So the point is, people, is that there's always more to the story. There's always two sides to everything. So just when you hear some guy out there going, oh, I'm going to do a short case against this company, doesn't necessarily mean they're doing it just because it's a way to make money. They might actually believe that particular stock is overvalued. And a lot of times they just ask simple questions because they're curious. It doesn't mean anything. Now, unfortunately, we are a type of business that's vulnerable to the more Barry Minkow types, because a lot of our stock is bought by distributors. And distributors, by their nature, are a very fickle, flighty bunch of people that spook easily. I think I wrote in an article a few years ago, I said, network marketing distributors, every bump in the road is Mount Everest, every puff of smoke is a mushroom cloud. We as a group, present company excluded, of course, because most people that are probably taking the time to listen to a podcast like this are probably people that are taking the business a little more seriously. But the majority of people in this business just don't take it that seriously, and they're easy to spook. So you say just, you know, something even a little bit negative about a publicly traded MLM company, and a lot of investors will bail very quickly. And some less ethical people, like Barry Minkow and his cohorts, have figured out, you know, that's a way to make money. But that was not the case with David Einhorn and Herbalife, not at all. What's ironic, though, about that is that the company he did make a short case against at the Irisone conference was a company called Martin Marietta Materials, whose ticker symbol is MLM. Again, that's just sheer coincidence, but I thought that was just very ironic, actually, that he didn't go after Herbalife, but did go after a company with a ticker symbol MLM. All right, let's get into these fake MLM gurus. This is the thing that I really wanted to kind of get off my chest right now. There are just a lot of what I call posers and pretenders in this business. And there are a lot of people that present themselves as a quote-unquote expert in network marketing that I've gotten to know, have spoken to, have interviewed, that I found out are just unbelievably ignorant about even some of the most basic fundamental things about this business. I've always got to explain this. Ignorant does not mean dumb or stupid. Ignorant means ignorant. It's a lack of education, a lack of information. Yet these are people that are perceived as great experts, great authorities on the industry. Now, some of them really are. To my knowledge, I think there's about maybe a dozen court-certified experts. But by that I mean, in a jury trial, they were designated an expert. Now, anybody can call themselves an expert and testify in depositions or as a consultant or something like that. But to testify before a jury, one side says, here's our expert. The other side gets to challenge that expert and say, they're not really an expert. They don't get to testify. The first time I testified before a jury, that's what happened. And it's hard to present yourself as an expert in a business that there's no degree in. You know, I can't call myself a PhD. There's no certification or anything I can point to, like a CPA or something. Fortunately, I wrote a book. I guess that helped, because I remember the judge just kind of standing through the book going, yeah, you wrote a book. But, you know, somehow they said, yes, you've got enough credibility here. You've got enough information to prove that you're an expert in this particular field. You can testify as an expert. But I was challenged. Usually after you get challenged once, you never get challenged again. Previous court has said you're an expert. Okay, you're an expert. In the case of MLM experts, I get challenged about every time now before I testify before a jury. And every single time, I get designated an expert. I've been in cases where that MLM expert that was designated got thrown out because they found that he or she wasn't really an expert. So that can happen. But anyway, anybody can call themselves an expert. So I always love it how people say, you know, Len is an actual official court-certified expert in network marketing when I'm saying things that supports their company. But as soon as I say something negative about it, suddenly I become a self-proclaimed expert. It always flips. But no, I'm not a self-proclaimed. I've been designated an expert by a court of law. And I had a friend a few years ago where he was very upset about diploma mills that give fake PhDs. And he had earned a PhD. And I asked him at the time, I said, why are you so upset about this? I can get why you have a little resentment or something, but And he kept saying, well, I work so hard to really earn that. And these guys get to put PhD at the end of their name or something because they, you know, they just paid a diploma mill to do it. And I get that now. I really get where that resentment comes from. I mean, I worked really hard to my own financial and personal detriment for the last 21 years to become an expert in this particular field. People always ask, like, Len, how come you never, you know, remarried? I'm divorced. And I say, because I'm kind of married to this career and I've got to focus on this. So that's what I mean by to my own personal detriment. So I kind of resent it when somebody just comes along and knows practically nothing about this business and calls themselves an expert and gets presented or edified as such. Because these posers, these pretenders, they got all these enablers out there that prop them up as great experts in the business, who themselves, I mean, maybe genuinely blind to the truth. I don't know. But when one expert says another person is an expert, or one guru edifies another guru, it gives more credibility to the second guru, and they're not really a guru. And I'm not going to name names here, and I'll tell you why at the end of this little rant, because normally on this podcast, I am going to name names. But I am going to give you some specific examples, so you can kind of see the level of egregiousness that I'm referring to out there. For example, there's one particular person who's considered one of the top authorities right now on network marketing. And recently, in his online website, as opposed to the websites that are not online, I guess, he claimed that there are 50 million distributors in the United States, 50 million MLM distributors in the United States, and there's about 11 or 12 million. So maybe that's a little nitpicky, but still, if you're such an authority on network marketing and such an expert in it, how do you not know that you're not even in the ballpark of the number of distributors? Now, again, that was just a little one. There is a situation, this is just a few weeks ago, where someone on a call, a live presentation, was edifying this person as a great expert in the business, a great authority, a great trainer who's had tons of success, who's now going to tell all of us how to be successful in network marketing. Well, I know this person who was being presented very well, and I know that his actual track record looks like this. Terminated from his first network marketing company, sued for wrongful termination, and lost, was the only distributor in the 10-plus year history of his second MLM company to have ever been terminated from that company, sued for wrongful termination, and lost. I also know that except for 1 year when he happened to recruit someone else who created a very big downline and got a matching bonus off of them, never made more than $2,000 or $3,000 a month in that company. Then went on to take a corporate position and was fired after just a few months for non-performance. Then took another distributor position and completely failed. Then completely disappeared from the MLM radar for about a decade. And now is suddenly coming back as this great MLM guru who's going to lead us all to all of this success. And this is someone, by the way, who I remember, he used to promote a lot of pictures of himself in front of this big million-dollar house as evidence of all of his success that he's had in network marketing. But I happen to know that that house was inherited. It had nothing to do with his success in MLM. The point is, this is someone who was just presented as a great authority on network marketing, a great expert, a great trainer, and it just simply wasn't true. There's another very well-known person in the business who, if you ask him for his history, he'll talk about how he created this huge income, retired, but then decided to help some other people start an MLM company. It's not his MLM company. He helped some other people start it. And then came out of retirement because this particular company had such a phenomenal product that he had to be involved in. Well, first of all, it was his company. He didn't help some other people start it. And it failed primarily because it was selling what was eventually exposed to be a completely fraudulent product, which I honestly believe he didn't know was fraudulent at the time, but it proved out to be a fraudulent product. And the company that he joined, he had already had a corporate position with previously. He didn't come out of retirement because he loved their product. Since then, their product actually has been discredited. But the point is, his whole track record is completely embellished. I remember this was back in the mid-90s when Charles King was doing his, what were basically for-profit seminars at the University of Illinois, Chicago. These were called certificate programs, which means somebody had access to a laser printer. These were not an accredited course. It wasn't actually part of the University of Chicago curriculum. I'm just saying that because that itself was fine. The seminar was great. People paid a few $100 to go there. This is nothing against Charles King, by the way. But basically, it was a for-profit seminar. It wasn't really University of Chicago teaching anything, but that's how it was presented. But one of the people who were speaking on stage that people paid several $100 to hear from as the compensation plan expert, this was the person who was going to go up on stage, teach this room full of people, which I understand the first few they had were there were several hundred people there at each one. The designated comp plan expert was going to teach them about comp plans. This person called me before the very first event and said, Len, I've been told that you actually are know a lot about comp plans. Can you help me out, just kind of brush up on some comp plans, because I'm about to present as a comp plan expert at this Charles King event? And I said, sure, no problem. So he asked me how Unilevel and Matrix plans worked. And I said, well, what part? What part of them don't you understand? He goes, all of them. I mean, pretty much start from the beginning and tell me how those plans work. I go, wait a minute, you're going to be the comp plan expert that people are paying hundreds of dollars to go see as a comp plan expert, and you don't even know the basic fundamentals of how a matrix or unilevel plan work. He understood breakaways because he was in one. And then after I spent about an hour explaining all of this to him, I asked him, well, do you want to know about binary plans? Because this is, what, 94, I think it was. Binary plans were really hot around this time. And companies like Market America and USANA had just come out with them and things like that. So, and his response to that was, what's a binary? He was oblivious to the fact that that type of plan even existed. And when I explained a little bit to him, he said, don't worry about those. So he didn't even cover those. And again, comp plan expert. Oh, there's also a very well-known author. By the way, don't try to reverse engineer my clues here and figure out who I'm talking about. I'm tweaking some of these facts and figures just a little bit. It doesn't take anything away from what I'm saying, but just kind of protect the innocent. So just like MLM author, well, that narrows it down to about 500 people. But there was one that was very, very popular and had some very popular book about MLM. And he had me actually edit the compensation plan and definition of term section of his first book. And he had things in there like the definition of a matrix was any plan where you can go no wider than three people on any level, like 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, and specifically three. That was a matrix plan. Compression and compressed unilevel, the definitions were completely reversed, just things like that. And I remember as I'm editing this going, but this is a person who's being hired to speak in front of large audiences as some kind of great authority on network marketing. There's another person right now, and this was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, I guess. It's not one of the worst examples, but it was just one of the more recent ones that really kind of was the catalyst to my wanting to talk about this. Very well-known, very well-respected authority on network marketing recently was on a live presentation and said that he had over 250,000 distributors in his downline. Well, he's a distributor for a publicly traded company. So you can look and see what their data is, what their sales are and things like that. And they have recent data, as of just last February, that shows the company only has 50,000 distributors total in the company. It's also a company, by the way, who's been around for many, many years. He joined it several years after it launched, after most of those 50,000 people would already have been in. And yet somehow now today claims he has a downline of over 250,000 distributors. This is something, by the way, if anyone cared enough and wanted to do anything to kind of vet any of these claims, you can find out in 5 minutes if it's true or not. But just nobody does. There's a very well-known trainer, a person who's he's written books, he gets hired to speak on stage, a very well-known authority in this business about network marketing. Well, I spoke at an event in a foreign market, I'll just say that, other side of the world, very, very far away. And my interpreter at this event, were talking over lunch one time, and we were talking about the challenge of I'm only being asked to speak for about 6 hours that afternoon. And the people that were hosting me had paid a lot of money, obviously, to fly me out there, and they were paying me thousands of dollars to speak and so forth for about three different events in three different cities. My challenge was, can I get all my content in just 6 hours? I said, it's too bad that we couldn't have broken up this into 2 days or whatever. And then he's told me this little anecdote. He said, there's this other person, this other trainer that's very well known in the United States. He was here a few months ago, hosted by the same group to train, and he was going to speak for 4 hours. And about an hour and a half into his presentation, he leans over to me. This is the interpreter talking. And he says, "I've got a problem." And he goes, "Okay, what's that?" He goes, "I'm out of material." Okay, now remember, this would have been plenty of advance notice that this person would have had to produce 4 hours of material, and now had been flown all the way around the world. It's now in front of this audience to speak for 4 hours, and came with an hour and a half of material. Okay, one of the most well-respected trainers in the business today. These people that call themselves experts and consultants and things like that, there's this one particular person who I can provide probably several examples of. I'll just give you one. I know of a case that I took as an expert witness where I replaced another expert witness. And this other expert witness, very well-known authority on the business, took the gig, basically. And, they had interviewed him and they told him what the case was and so forth. And he said, "Yeah, okay, I'll be your expert witness." And they sent him a $5,000 retainer check. And when this other expert got the retainer check, he noticed that the check was drawn from the company's account. And apparently realized for the very first time he had just agreed to represent the company. Okay, it was a wrongful termination case. And he didn't understand that. So he sent the check back. He goes, "I didn't understand that I was being asked to represent the..." He didn't even know which side he was representing at the time that he accepted the job and accepted the retainer. So they had to come to me and go, like, "Glenn, we can't use him. Would you take the case?" By the way, most people in this business go, "Well, no, we want to defend the distributor." Well, I actually look at both sides. And what I find is that more than half the time, wrongful terminations are not wrongful. When you get both sides of the story, I've had situations where I've heard the distributor side, and no matter how compelling it is, no matter how obvious they were wrongfully terminated, the moment I get the company side, I realize, you know what, that person absolutely should have been terminated. One of the most high-profile terminations of all time, I got the company side and got copies of the 6 different warning letters they sent this person before they were finally terminated, and all for absolute policy violations. But anyway, I kind of got both sides and said, "Well, yeah, this person should have been terminated. They were obviously cross-recruiting and so forth, so I did represent the company." But I had an idea of which side I was representing before I took the job. You know, I've seen all kinds of examples where I know of a guy who is considered a great successful leader in the business who actually married someone, and she had the big downline. Now, I'm not saying he didn't grow it larger, after that, but, I mean, he married into a big downline. And I've seen the opposite of that, actually more than once, where, a woman marries a guy with this large organization, and suddenly she's an MLM expert, and she's writing books and doing seminars, but she never built the downline. But understand, for any women flame me by email, it goes both ways. Like I said, I know guys who've married women who've had large downlines, and suddenly they're experts. I actually do, or did at one time, training calls for the ANMP, Association of Network Marketing Professionals, the trade association. And I interviewed this person who was an expert on generating leads. That's where they came on the call. And after about an hour of trying to pry one specific tip out of this person and how to generate a lead, which I liken to trying to pull teeth from a blue whale. And blue whales don't have teeth, by the way. That's how tough it was. I finally decided, I'm gonna do my own call on lead generation after this, because I promised that's what we're going to be talking about. And other than, well, you got to talk to people, that was it. Basically an hour of him saying, you got to talk to people. And in fact, just recently, I heard another person on another call for another association talk about lead generation, and for the entire hour didn't provide one single specific strategy on how to generate leads other than you got to talk to people or buy leads. I believe he did mention you can buy leads. In fact, that's one of the things that's really kind of bothered me recently is the trainers who don't know how to build a downline in a duplicatable way. That's what we really have to vet these leaders to find out, are they teaching you to build a downline in the way they built the downline? I guarantee you, anybody out there right now that's telling you to go make a list of 500 people from your warm market, and call up your college roommate from 1984 and pitch them on your company. Of course, you always start off with asking them how they're doing and make it, pretend like you're interested in them. I guarantee you that's not how they built their downline. So many times I hear these these trainers talk, and they talk for an hour, and I hang up and I sit back and I go, okay, what is one thing they just taught me I can actually do in my business? And I can't think of a single thing. They're basically what my friend Dave Claybore used to call a brain orgasm. You know, I mean, while you're hearing it, you're thinking you're getting all of this good stuff, or these events you go to, and you listen to them talk for the whole afternoon, and then you're on your way home, you think, now what can I do in my business? And you can't think of a single thing they just told you can actually do. That's why I like people like John Fogg or Tom Schreider. Tom Schreider is great at this, Big Al. He gives you very specific, step-by-step things you can actually do in your business. And that's actually very rare today. There's so many of the leaders today in this business that have made a lot of money have done it in a very unduplicatable way. For one thing, they make deals. Now, I'm not against deals, and I'll do another whole rant on deals on another show, but as long as there's full disclosure. And there isn't full disclosure. I know someone right now that I remember doing some consulting, helping design the comp plan for this one particular startup company a few years ago, and it was launched by the top distributors from another company. They had left that company to start their own company. I'm in the home office, and they're saying, look at this, Len. We got 4,000 applications sitting on the desk, people waiting to sign up. This company didn't even have a name yet. They could not possibly have been signing up because they love the product or whatever. They didn't have a product line yet. 4,000 people, though, waiting to sign up. And when they launched, their number one distributor, the master distributor, that's what they call the person who's the apex of the entire national organization at the very top. That person is bragging about how they made $10,000 within just 3 months. 3 months, and I've already up to $10,000. Never bothering to tell anybody that it's because he moved a big chunk of his downline from the previous company over, and he was the master distributor. So, not that that wasn't duplicatable. If he built it there in a very organic, natural way, and he moves them over, that still might be called duplicatable, because originally it was duplicatable, but not the speed in which it was earned. The 10,000 in 3 months, that was totally unduplicatable because nobody else has a big downline to move over that fast. Now, I remember I was in a company called Beverly Hills International, which was actually based in Indianapolis, Indiana at the time. That should have been my first red flag. And I found out after a few months of working with this company, I remember we had about 2,600 distributors at the time. Anyway, long story short, I found out that it was funded by some less than reputable people, and so I decided I was going to leave. And I had some partners at the time that were also well known in the industry, and we called ourselves the Freestyles team, and it was the four of us. And all of a sudden, these companies started calling us, saying, okay, you guys are leaving, come to our company. Now remember, this is back in the mid-90s, and someone in corporate at USANA, who is no longer there, by the way, offered us a position frontline to the company and double the comp plan. Every percentage in the plan, double it just for our group, top secret. At the time, Life Plus, and again, involving people no longer with the company, so I don't want to implicate either of these companies today, completely different situation, but back in the mid-90s, they offered us a frontline position to the company and the first six positions below the company, so basically we're like sextuple dipping. And they had another leg of 1,200 people they were going to move under us. So in other words, our success would have been completely unduplicatable. And there are no secrets in this business. It's the world's biggest grapevine. So when you do this, when corporate is, this is probably another rant for another day, but when corporate is competing against their own distributors for the top talent, which is what they're doing when they put people frontline to the company after they launch. Before they launch, there's no one else to recruit but the company. After you launch, no one else should go frontline to the company, because if they are, that means you're competing with your own company for distributors. If an orphan distributor or leader comes to the company, they should go under a distributor someplace. So in our case, I remember Corey Augenstein and I, Corey from MLM Insider, we had a bad experience with our previous company. Like I said, we didn't really get to know the owners as well as we should have. So we flew out to Batesville, Arkansas to check out Life Plus, to really see how these guys operate, to see who they really were, meet them face to face. So our idea was we were going to take them out and ply them with a bunch of beer and kind of really see how they act with their guard down. And so we went to Batesville, Arkansas to do that and found out it was a dry county. So we found out what these guys were really like by buying them coffee. But anyway, we got spotted out there. So next thing we know, within 48 hours, the CEO of the company at the time calls us up and goes, hey guys, could you put something in writing saying that you were just checking us out and you haven't joined Life Plus? And we're like, okay, why? Because we're just getting deluged with all of these calls and angry faxes and stuff. There weren't a lot of email back then from people going, you dirty, rotten so-and-sos, you must have put those guys frontline to the company because they're not anybody's downline. You know, these freestyles team guys, we know you went out there and we're checking them out. So everybody was calling everybody else's upline going, are they in your downline? Oh, they're not in my downline. Are they in yours? No. Hey, let's call the guy all the way at the top. Called him up. Nope, they're not in my downline either. Oh, those companies, that must have put them frontline to the company. We had to, like, explain to people that, well, no, we're not in anybody's downline because we didn't join that company. Seriously considered it, but we didn't join it. In fact, we went with a company called Longevity Network, which I was with them from about 95 to 2003. And that's where I had most of my success. So the point is that people are going to eventually find this stuff out anyway. So it's, I remember one time this guy was flashing a $121,000 check. And they found out in depositions when some people left and sued corporate and whatever that that check was never cashed. During the discovery process in this court case, they found out that $121,000 check their top distributor was flashing around at all these different meetings, it was never cashed. So I don't know about you guys, but the first time my check gets to $121,000, one of the top two or three things I plan on doing with it is to take it down to the bank and cash it. So, anything, eventually it's going to get revealed. So you might as well have full disclosure, but they don't. There are so many people right now are making these deals, and they're not telling you that they made the deal. And I know I'm going off on a tangent. I'm probably going to go over an hour, but if you ever want to know how somebody made a deal, here's how you do it. You take the statement, no one compensated me in any way, and you take their explanation as to how they didn't make a deal. You subtract the two, and that's how they made the deal. Here's what I mean. Very high-level distributor left one company to go to another a few years ago. And his statement was, the company did not compensate me in any way. Well, subtract that from, no one compensated me in any way. What's left? Okay, who did compensate you? We found out later it was the owner of the company. Gave the guy a few million bucks. I know this woman that left one company went to another company, and her statement was, the company did not financially compensate me in any way. Subtract that from, no one compensated me in any way, and what's left? Okay, then how did they compensate you? And in this case, they gave her a big downline. So we're seeing a lot of people moving right now, and you notice how almost all the time they'll say, fill in the blank, name of the company, did not compensate me. Okay, then who did? And sure enough, it's coming from leaders in the field or from people in corporate doing personal deals and things like that. So, okay, I'm going to wrap this up. But the point is, there are absolutely very good leaders out there who really did build their downlines in a very organic, natural, duplicatable way. And those are the people. In fact, they're the majority. I mean, I'm just kind of picking out some of the worst examples, but it seems like some of the worst examples are the most high-profile, most well-respected leaders in the industry. Somehow they end up rising to the top because we as an industry don't vet our leaders. Vet, by the way, means to validate the person, to check them out, to make sure that they're authentic in this case. So that's why I'm not naming names here because that shouldn't be my job. I shouldn't have to be the bad cop that's going to get everybody all upset. You know, I mean, we get enough attacks from outside the industry that aren't warranted at all. And, you know, it's like, you know, Mark O'Neill has said, you know, we're the only industry where we turn our wagons in a circle and shoot inward. And we do that a lot. You know, there's too much competition bashing going on in this business and things like that. We don't need perceived leaders in the industry to start fighting amongst themselves. You know, I can just imagine, you know, all these anti-MLM critics out there, you know, just if they're sitting there with their popcorn, just watching the show, just with these big smiles on their faces. We don't need that. I don't need to be the one that alienates myself from everybody in the business that starts attacking all of these top leaders, all these basically sacred cows. But you need to do that. That's your job. As distributors, as participants in this business, you need to vet your leaders. Check them out. And sometimes it just takes a simple Google search. You know, like the guy with 250,000 distributors in his downline. You can find out in 5 minutes if that's true or not. And I think a lot of these people are counting on the fact that no one will check them out. So check out these people. You do it. Go out there and investigate them and ask them specifically. A lot of times it's sort of a don't ask, don't tell policy. If you ask them where you terminated from this company, they'll usually tell you, yeah, they'll try to rationalize it and so forth, but they'll never put it on their resume voluntarily. So, you know, ask them point blank. There's this one great leader in the industry that talks about how he made all this money in the business and then went into retirement and came out of retirement because this product was so great. This is a different one than the first one. And I asked him one time, well, who'd you make all that money with? And he told me the name of the company. And I called up the owner of that company, who was retired at the time. His company's gone now. And then he told me, he goes, yeah, that guy never made more than a couple of thousand dollars a month in that company. I mean, the whole process of asking the question, calling the person, finding that person's phone number, calling that person maybe 30 minutes to find out if that person was telling the truth or not. We need to vet our leaders in this business so we can know that when we hire people or we get on calls to listen to people like, I should have written down a list because this is going to be at the top of my head and I'm going to feel sorry about all the people who I forgot to mention here, but Ruth Van Buren, Michael Klaus, Sandy Cohen, Pete Sedanis, Donna Valdez, Dan and Becky Mays, Rod Nichols. I can go on and on and on. Point is, there are a lot of people out there where they did build it in a duplicatable way from the ground up. And these are the people that we need to start really showcasing more and more, and not the ones that are the fake gurus of the industry, the posers and the pretenders. And we need to stop being enablers to these people. If we're going to edify a leader on our call or our show or whatever, it's our responsibility to vet that person and to find out, is this person the real deal or not? And if they're not, don't put them on your show or your training call or whatever, or on stage at your events and tell people how great they are if it's not real. So we as distributors, the companies, the person who are showcasing these people in whatever venue it is, we need to vet our leaders and filter them and only let the legitimate ones come through. Now, on the next show, I'm going to get into a couple of companies that I'm probably getting more questions about than every other one combined right now. That's Zeke Rewards and Lioness. And hopefully by the time I do this, I'm going to have more information because, believe me, I'm never going to scoop anybody on anything in this business because I take too much time trying to get both sides of the story and investigate the person. I don't just do a Google keyword search and every time something pops up, I just throw it up on my website. It takes a little more than that here. So I'm trying to really do my due diligence and understand what I'm talking about before I comment on them. And believe me, I do have a lot of questions. And hopefully I can ask them directly amongst those people who are in these companies that can provide a definitive answer. It's not going to be hearsay or my speculation. I don't want to send them questions in advance or pose the questions here to give them a heads up as to what the question is, because it's kind of always been my philosophy in my investigative process or my interview process to not give the subject an advance notice as to what my questions or concerns are, because lies must be manufactured. The truth is ready-made. If you give them time to think up an answer, why do they have to do that if it's the truth? The truth is the truth, and you should know the truth immediately. So you shouldn't need any advanced warning or notice as to what my question is going to be. So I'm going to wait till I actually can speak to them and ask them the questions, and hopefully they'll agree to do that on the show. So let's see what happens there. If they don't, by the way, hey, they had their shot, and I'll go ahead and pose the questions here without their answers. But I, as I understand it, in both of these cases from both of these companies, these are people that are very open and willing to answer these types of questions, so I don't believe I'll have that problem. But anyway, that'll be coming up, as well as so many other things that I want to talk about. So that'll be it for this particular episode of Inside Network Marketing. By the way, if there's any other subjects that you would like me to cover, any companies that you're interested in getting any type of an investigation or opinion on, any kind of newsworthy events that you hear out there in the business that you think I should know about, please email me at marketwave@cox.net. Market, WAVE, at COX.NET. Otherwise, I'll see you back here on the next edition of Inside Network Marketing. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.